Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Passiani, and to begin, he commented on a new and exciting development in targeted treatment of non-small cell lung cancer, serologic assays to detect and monitor tumor mutations.
So the idea is that as cancers grow and divide, they shed their DNA. And when you're dealing with a cancer that has a mutation, like many lung cancers do, you can actually find that DNA in the blood of individuals. And you know it's coming from the cancer because these mutations are cancer specific. They're not in the individual's germline. And so you can use it as a tool to not only potentially diagnose someone non-invasively, the so-called liquid biopsy, but ultimately to perhaps monitor the disease. So if you have a EGFR mutant lung cancer, for example, you start out, you measure a lot of EGFR in their blood, they get treated with erlotinib or afatinib, it goes down and ultimately comes back up as the individual's cancer develops resistance. So it's a non-invasive way to see what's happening in the cancer and much easier to perform, of course, than multiple serial biopsies. And I think the technologies are really there now that they weren't there even just a couple of years ago to be able to do this.
The one place that I heard about something like this, and I'm wondering if it's the same thing, was at ASCO. Alicia Sequist presented some data, I think it was on a third generation EGFR TKI, where she brought in some serum assays. It sounds like what you're talking about here. Is it the same thing?
Yes, there's varying technologies, but yes, the same basic idea of not only diagnosing someone potentially non-invasively, but also then serial monitoring. And I think in that particular example, it's important because when patients develop resistance to targeted therapy, say an EGFR inhibitor, oftentimes, you know, biopsies may not be feasible or it takes too long to get the results from a biopsy. And so being able to do it from the blood and get a rapid answer has real clinical importance and value.
So I guess it was ASCO that I was talking to Alicia about this concept. And, you know, recently it seems like the paradigm has shifted in terms of the need for biopsy, if possible, in a patient who's on a first-line EGFR TKI who then has disease progression. First of all, at this point, do you consider that pretty much standard of care, even in the community setting?
Well, I think I would say it's almost there. It's almost there because we now know that the third generation EGFR inhibitors like AZD9291 or rosalitinib work much better in individuals that have those mutations, that T790M resistance mutation, compared to those that don't. So if you have access to those agents through a clinical trial or many of the others that are under clinical development, then absolutely, it's an important thing to know because that would dictate which direction you go with the treatment. Once those agents become commercially available, then it really does become standard of care.
Although I guess even at this point, when you look at the options in that situation, it seems like going on these new agents, even though they only are available on trial right now, I mean, it clearly is the best option.
Yes, yes. And certainly, I think if the decision, if someone started their therapy on frontline EGFR TKI and the choice is between chemotherapy and a new agent like this, I think many of us would want to use these new agents in that setting, especially in someone with a T790M mutation.
You know, it kind of reminds me that many situations in oncology I was kind of flashing on before ibrutinib was approved. And there were situations where there was no doubt it was the best therapy, and yet you could only get it on trial, and it kind of seems like that's the situation with these new agents. She also was, when I was talking with her, speculated that actually it's maybe only going to be a transient phase when biopsies are going to be indicated, and that these kinds of serum assays maybe are going to rapidly replace repeat biopsies. Do you think that's the case?
I think in this particular example, yes, and certainly many others as well. I think the speed is such an issue, speed of being able to do this. You know, for example, we do this at our center as a research test at the moment, and the results come back in 28 to 48 hours. And right now it's being transitioned into a clinical laboratory. And whereas tumor genotyping, be it by whatever next generation method, is still 2 to 3 weeks. And many times patients can't wait. So I think it's a real game changer for lung cancer and many other cancers, solid tumors, where you can measure these in the blood.
What about other mutations? Are there assays, you know, for ALK rearrangements, for BRAF, et cetera?
The point mutation ones are easier. KRAS there is, BRAF there is. And again, some of that comes from the colon cancer world where this has also been pioneered. Rearrangements are still a bit of a challenge. Many of the technologies can't capture the rearrangements. There you really need a sequencing-based technology. There are emerging technologies that are able to do this, and we haven't quite seen them yet in a clinical application, but the hope is that there will be there as well. And ultimately, I think, you know, you could have a panel of lung-focused genetic alterations that you use instead or to supplement biopsy information. And I think that's where we're going. I think we'll see that very soon in real clinical applications.
So to just identify the mutation, that sounds like that'd be a great step. But also the issue of the level, you know, how much of it's there. I mean, does this look like this has the potential to be a tumor marker?
Yeah, I think the level part still probably needs some work. Now, some assays are quantitative, some are not. So if you have a quantitative assay, absolutely. Maybe the level and the degree by which the level decreases, right? So, you know, I'm not sure we're yet at the point that any of these assays are sort of the BCR-ABL level of detection, meaning that if you become negative, that has prognostic implications. But I think it's worth studying at this point. And I think we now have the tools and technologies to do that. And I think now's the opportunity to study. And if it ultimately turns out to be the case that if you don't clear your mutation or the time it takes to clear the mutation if you start on a targeted therapy is somehow an adverse prognostic piece of information or predictive piece of information, then I think that that will be clinically useful for patients, you know, moving forward.
Yeah, I also wonder, you know, people have a lot of concerns about flare when you stop an EGFR TKI, and I'm going to ask you about that. But do you think that maybe somehow this technique or quantification of it could predict the people who might flare or the people where you ought to continue it, for example?
Yeah, I think it's certainly worth looking at. I wonder if the flare is, you know, it's kinetically so quick. I don't know if it'll be a purely a change in the DNA, maybe something else. But certainly I think, again, it gets back to the level question that, you know, I think that there are multiple studies that should be and could be now done, I think, to address these issues. And no question, this is a tool that will inform us what to do in the clinic.
Yeah, I was just fantasizing that maybe you start out with a high level, it goes way down, and then on relapse, you know, maybe it goes way up, or maybe it's only up a little bit. You know, this whole thing about sometimes people have, you know, just slight imaging changes and they're
right,
clinically stable. You know, whether you want to use a local modality like RFA, I don't know, I could envision that maybe we could kind of figure all that out.
I think it'll give us additional information that we won't necessarily get from scans. And I think that's the nice piece, especially the assays that are quantitative, because then you can really look at it over time.
Any comment about the strategy, again, of using local therapy and continuing systemic treatment, in this case, EGFR TKI? What are some of the clinical scenarios that you're commonly encountering? What kinds of local therapy? How many different sort of escape lesions will you treat locally?
So certainly brain metastases is an easy one. So, you know, progression in the CNS, no systemic progression, and certainly if it's isolated. I mean, there I think it's really an issue of drug penetration into the CNS. And so I think there it's an easy decision to use local therapy and then continue systemic therapy. I think in the rest of the body, single solitary lesions, bone lesions, solitary chest lesion, we do that. I think there the concern a little bit is that is it just the tip of the iceberg and ultimately you're going to start to see other lesions emerge as well. But certainly if there's clear evidence of sort of one area growing and others not, we tend to try to use local modalities.
You know, the explanation I've heard, you know, is kind of like an aberrant clone. Do you think that actually is the case of what's really going on?
Well, I think different areas probably have different selection pressures. And, you know, we do think that this is probably a selection pressure. And so it may be that in some areas you've created a selection pressure that allows growth, whereas it doesn't in others. The whole sort of resistance and heterogeneity of how this emerges is still not completely clear. But I mean, I think the understanding is, and certainly when people have looked at this, that you can certainly have clonal evolution, essentially. It's an evolutionary process. You can have clonal evolution where one clone starts to take off, whereas others are still kept in control.
Let's talk about the third generation agents. Maybe we can start out with AZD9291. Does that have a name yet?
No.
Yeah, seems like it really needs one. Anyhow, maybe you can talk about your New England Journal paper on that drug and what we've learned since then about it.
I think we learned a couple things from that study. Number one is that there's clearly an effective drug, and the efficacy was across multiple dose levels from 20 to 240 milligrams. The efficacy was greater in the T790M positive populations, both measured by response and PFS, and that this class of drugs, although they are selective for the mutant over the wild type form of EGFR, as you start to get into higher and higher doses in the AZ study, when you got into 160 and 240 milligram doses, you started to see some effect on inhibiting wild-type EGFR, and hence the dose that was taken forward and is currently being taken forward is the 80 milligram dose.
Wild-type in terms of diarrhea and rash?
Skin and diarrhea, yeah. And so fortunately, you have a very nice cushion or therapeutic window because, again, there's efficacy even at 20 and, of course, at 40 milligrams.
That's interesting, though. I didn't even know they caused rash. So it can cause rash and diarrhea.
It can at high enough doses. And some of that, don't see it too much with the ruxolitinib drug. Some of the other ones that are out there, there's one from Korea, the Hanmi drug, and that does seem also at higher doses to have some wild-type EGFR-like activity. Some of the other ones are still earlier on. There's a lot of interest in drugs in this space because, of course, are very much an unmet medical need for patients.
You know, in terms of the tumors without the T790 mutation, is the activity enough that, I mean, for example, if that were the activity of the drug, is that clinically useful?
Yeah, so interesting enough, so, you know, there's about a 20% response rate for the AZD drug in that paper. Now, some of that could be retreatment effect, so we didn't mandate that individuals came off just a prior EGFR TKI and then went on to the trial. And if you looked at that population specifically, individuals who came off a prior EGFR TKI and then went on the trial, the response rate was only 11%. The PFS in that negative population in and of itself is only 2.8 months. So, you know, if that's your second-line therapy, probably chemotherapy is better in that situation. Immunotherapy may be better too. And so it doesn't mean that it's without its activity, it's just that it's certainly less.
Right. About what fraction of these patients, I know it's kind of hard to say, maybe different situations, et cetera, but are T790 positive?
So patients who fail erlotinib, for example, it's about 60%, 65%, so maybe 35 to 40% are negative. And of course, negative isn't one category. It's a summation of other types of resistance mechanisms. So we think of it as a much more heterogeneous population than the patients that have T790M.
Just finishing out with the AZ compound, where are things heading right now in terms of clinical drug development with this agent? There were some data, you were involved with this again at ASCO, looking at it up front. Do you think that's where things are heading?
Yeah, so I think first there have been subsequent completed phase two single agent trials, essentially two trials that have been completed that we hope to hear about later on in the year. A randomized trial that's ongoing versus chemotherapy in someone who's failed an EGFR TKI and has a T790M. So that's ongoing. And then the cohort that you mentioned is the first line cohort that was part of the phase one study. And there, the question really was in somebody who hasn't had an EGFR TKI, what's the response rate? And ultimately, of course, what's the PFS there? And Dr. Ramalingam presented that at ASCO. And interesting enough, there is about a 70% response rate overall and a PFS that's too early to say, but looks promising. And so I think an interesting and intriguing set of information. Interestingly enough, that there is already an ongoing randomized trial ongoing of AZD9291 versus gefitinib or erlotinib as initial therapy in EGFR mutant lung cancer.
Now, in that trial or other trials, I guess, you know, kind of reminds me of what's going on with ALK right now. You're kind of looking at what's happening after the first two treatments, in a sense, if you want to look at it that way. You know, in the long run, is the patient maybe better off starting on the less effective drug, I guess? Does that rationale apply in this situation, or is it being thought about?
I think it's being thought about, and I think we have a bunch of unknowns here as well. So I think, and this also applies to the ALK situation, you know, do you do sort of sequential kinase inhibitors? You know, do you start with erlotinib and then do the next generation drug, et cetera, or do you start with the next generation drug first? ALK, of course, you have three potential drugs now to do that. And I think those sequencing questions aren't clear, of course. I think one concern on the EGFR front is that if you start with your most potent agent, is that ultimate duration of PFS shorter than if you did the sequential approach? And what happens at the end of that? What kind of resistance emerges out of that? So I think you need to do the clinical trial to get an idea. And you can, of course, model some of these in laboratory-based things. But I think you need to do the clinical trial to figure that out. But certainly some unknowns.
So let's talk a little bit about ruxolitinib. And again, we saw some data Alicia presented at ASCO looking at this and also with this plasma genotyping. Can you talk about that data set as well as the New England Journal data set and basically what we know about this drug right now?
Yeah, so certainly in the EGFR T790M positive patients, activity is similar in terms of response rate to the AZD drug, you know, sort of 50-60% response rate. I think they've had a little bit more issues finding the right dose for the drug. There's been some toxicities associated with it, hyperglycemia and QTC prolongation, which is forced to come back to lower doses of the drug. And those are now currently going forward. Reasonable activity also in the T790M negative patient population. Again, I think whether that's due to the effect of the drug, whether that's due to heterogeneity amongst the tumor, other activities that the drug may have, I think are still somewhat unknown in that regard.
Can you separate at all from an efficacy point of view these two drugs? You mentioned T790 negative. Does it look more active than, you know, for example, the AZ compound in those patients?
Yeah, I think it's hard to, you know, if you just compare percentages, it seems to be the case. I think it's hard to say that for sure. I mean, I think testing varies in terms of the patient population. Was it centrally tested negative and locally positive, et cetera? I think you'd really need to do a head-to-head if you wanted to compare to that. And I'm not sure that's where we should be going. I think that the negatives are a population that's made up of many different things. And I think that's where the combination therapies, I think, will ultimately hopefully have a home there in that negative population.
You know, it's certainly, you know, when you see novel agents that by themselves are having this kind of activity, you know, people want to use them. And as you say, it's pretty likely that that's going to happen. So far, just sort of looking at it from afar, they kind of look similar, except the hyperglycemia with the rosalitinib. Is there any other way right now you can differentiate them?
Yeah, I think if you look at the PFS numbers, they vary a little bit. You know, for the AZ, the updated PFS, the 80 milligram dose we presented at the ELCC meeting was about 13 months there. There's an updated PFS for rosalitinib that was presented at ASCO, which was, I think, about 8 or 9 months. So, and again, the numbers were a little bit different for the New England Journal papers for both of them. So I think they're all in that range. I don't think that there's a huge difference between them at this point. I think the toxicity is certainly one difference that has come out so far.
Globally, what's your take in terms of sort of the fraction of patients where you're going to have to do something about the hyperglycemia with the rosalitinib?
Well, certainly, you know, you probably have to monitor in everybody because right. You can't predict who's going to get it. So that adds its own issues to your sort of routine workflow and taking care of patients. And then it's probably about a quarter that you have to actually do something about the hyperglycemia.
And what fraction is it like anything other than easy to manage? I hear that it's easy.
It's easy, and I think a much smaller fraction of those individuals require more than just metformin. They require other types of anti-diabetic agents to keep their blood sugars under control.
I guess the bottom line is if both were available, how would you utilize them?
Well, I think there are choices there, obviously, and people can, you know, certainly, you know, look at them sort of head-to-head on an efficacy basis. It's hard to draw a huge line in the sand. I think you can make that conclusion based on the side effect profile for sure. I think the other thing that we don't have complete information on either one of them is certainly CNS penetration, right? I mean, so is one of them better, you know, like in the ALK situation where we have drugs like alectinib that seem to have much better CNS penetration than crizotinib. Those may be additional factors that will learn about over time that will really help differentiate one from the other. And don't forget, there are about 3 or 4 others out there in clinical development as well. So the pool of drugs that are targeting their EGFR, their erlotinib-resistant patients is quite huge. And I think the differences in some of these clinical activities and certainly in the side effects will ultimately dictate one over the other. And I think at the end of the day, in the dedicated phase 2 trials or phase 3 trials, looking at the efficacy, which one of them has at least the appreciable better PFS will be important.
So kind of pulling back a little bit more globally on the issue of mutations in general, I wonder if you could comment on the poster that, again, you were involved with at this past ASCO meeting, feasibility of next-generation sequencing for squamous non-small cell lung cancer, implications for the NCI Lung Map study. Now, I want to use that as an introduction, first of all, in general, to the whole idea of targeted therapy of squamous cell, the master protocol in terms of where that's at, and also what you were trying to get across in this poster.
Well, it was really trying to get an idea of how feasible is it to do targeted next-generation sequencing in squamous cell in general? We've mostly focused on adenocarcinomas, of course, because that's where really the pool of targetable alterations exist. So the idea was to look at it in squamous cell populations. And you certainly do get a sense that there may be a slightly higher fail rate in the squamous cell population than what you'd anticipate normally for the adenocarcinoma population. But I think the other piece there was, and sort of to put it in context, was to ask, well, if we actually go through the effort of doing this, and what fraction could this be helpful? And I think the LungMap protocol is a good example of that, since that's trying to use that platform to assign therapies to patients, and hence the reason to kind of compare it in that kind of context.
And of course, that protocol looks for a number of targeted mutations coupled with a specific agent. And then for patients who don't have that, some kind of immunotherapy. I know, what's the current immunotherapy treatment in those patients? And at one point it was PD-1, anti-PD-1.
Yeah, I think it's the MEDI4736 that was presented that will be in the non-targetable arms of individuals. I think the other issue with that protocol, of course, is that, you know, now that we have randomized clinical trials and an approval of nivolumab for squamous cell lung cancer, how will that get altered and et cetera? So that, I think, remains to be seen.
Right, because the last I heard, there was some thought about the possibility of, you know, combining anti-PD-1 agent or PD-L1 agent with an anti-CTLA-4 agent. What do we know about that strategy right now in lung cancer? Obviously, you've seen some interesting things in melanoma.
Yeah, there's some early data suggesting that it could be also effective in lung cancer, and many trials currently underway combining those two approaches. Interesting data at ASCO emerging in small cell lung cancer on that as well, also in non-small cell lung cancer. So I think that although there's activity of the single agents, the PD-1s, the PD-L1s, I think that there's a hope that in lung cancer, the combination activity will be even better, just like it has been in melanoma, and hopefully not associated with a tremendous degree of toxicity. I think the earlier versions of those trials had a little bit more toxicity, and I think more recently the cohorts have gotten to a much more tolerable range.
Sort of globally, what do we know right now in terms of the fraction of patients with squamous cell who have, you know, driver mutations, and how many of these might be potentially susceptible to an agent?
Yeah, it's a minority. It's not a majority. So you have the FGFRs, you have some alterations in the PI3 kinase pathway. Those are really the major ones that you could target in terms of with a kinase inhibitor. CDK4 alterations as well. But I think it still leaves the majority. And of course, that's where the hope is that the immunotherapies will be effective. And if you look at sort of the predictors of what people have come up with immunotherapy in terms of that, you know, it may work better in smokers versus never smokers who develop lung cancer, this whole concept of mutational burden, which should be and is known to be higher in squamous cells versus adenos. I think that there'll still be some refinement in there, but I think that that's the hope there for the therapies. And, you know, as you know, targeted therapies have not been quite as successful in the development approaches, although they have been tried, but haven't quite been so successful in squamous cell lung cancer.
Yeah, that concept of mutational load was sounding really good until we got to ASH and saw the benefits of anti-PD-1 in Hodgkin lymphoma.
Yeah,
and then I was like, whoa, what happened to the mutation theory?
Yeah, it may hold in some cancers, maybe not in others. And I think that's an interesting part in the whole immunotherapy field in general is, do learnings from one cancer always inform what's happening in the other? And it's not clear yet. It's a very exciting and interesting area and really just amazingly evolving in front of our eyes.
Really is. And, you know, of course, the natural people are always thinking about combining things. And we're starting to see some work, and you were involved with this also, looking at combining these checkpoint inhibitors with targeted therapy. There was a work Jeff Oxnard presented on the TATIN trial.
Yes.
Can you talk about that and other trials looking to combine targeted therapy or EGFR therapy with checkpoint inhibitors?
Right. So in that particular one, again, it was based on the third generation inhibitor. That phase one trial had three arms. All of them had the AZD9291, one had the MEDI4736, one had selumetinib, the MEK inhibitor, and the third arm had a MET inhibitor. And all three of them had some activity. It was really a phase one clinical trial. But I think the idea, and there are erlotinib combination trials underway already of various different combinations of immunotherapy and erlotinib. And I think the idea really is to figure out, is there synergistic effects of these two agents? Now, unfortunately, we haven't done in any of these trials is really ask the question, when should you combine these agents? Do you really need to give them up front together, or do you give one and then wait to give the other? And that question hasn't been asked. I think the other issue, getting back to the mutational load thing, is EGFR mutant patients tend to be never smokers. They tend to perhaps have genetically simpler cancers than those that are found in heavy smokers. And so, again, that may be a category of lung cancer that has a low mutational load compared to others. And whether that is the right place to combine these agents remains to be seen.
In a weird kind of way, it reminds me of some of the discussions we've heard about in lymphoma or CLL, where you know the idea maybe of giving some of these small molecule inhibitors like ibrutinib to decrease the tumor load, then coming in this case with, for example, CAR T and immunotherapy, kind of gets a little bit into whether or not these immunotherapies or checkpoint inhibitors work better with lower tumor burden or higher tumor burden. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely the case. You know, is that the right scenario? Or give it a maintenance therapy after chemotherapy? So I do think that there are many questions still to be explored. I think one of the challenges with the immunotherapy is that unlike targeted therapies or things that inhibit signaling pathways, we don't have a lot of good preclinical models. And preclinical models require a competent immune system, and very few mouse models have competent immune systems. And even the ones that do, it's not 100% clear it's the same as the human immune system. And so you almost have to do the experiments in the clinic to figure that out. And I think there's so many of them going on at the current time. We will, within a short period of time, have at least some ideas of what may be the right approach. Maybe it's too toxic to give these two agents together. Maybe you need to separate them, or maybe the efficacy is much better when you do separate. And I think we'll hopefully learn all that.
There was a paper by Gaynor et al. At ASCO looking at the frequency of a program death or PD-L1 expression in EGFR mutant and ALK rearranged non-small cell. What did they see, and what do you think it means?
It was a little bit lower than what we would normally anticipate. And I think it may mean that maybe these sort of oncogene-addicted cancers are not ones that activate these pathways as much as other types of cancers. And I think that's okay, because for the last several years, our targeted therapies have focused on a subpopulation of lung cancer patients with mutations. But at the end of the day, they don't make up the majority of lung cancer. And having therapies that target the non-oncogene-addicted cancers, the more genetically complex cancers, having strategies for that group of patients is great. So I think it's okay.
And of course, at ASCO, we finally saw data in the second line comparing the anti-PD-1 antibody, in this case, nivolumab, to docetaxel in non-squamous cancer, the so-called CheckMate 57 trial. And as in squamous, we saw about a 20% response rate, with many of those responses long-lived, and a survival benefit with a hazard ratio of 0.73. But getting back to EGFR and ALK, I wonder if you could comment a little bit on the Alchemist trial. It's a great trials in progress poster that you were a part of at ASCO going through that study. What exactly is it looking at?
Well, there it's really trying to look at a couple things. One is to centrally test patients for EGFR and ALK rearrangements using a uniform platform. And that's really the screening part of the study. But the idea then is that if you find individuals with those, then there are two randomized clinical trials, both of these now in the early stage setting. So once you've completed definitive therapy for early stage lung cancer, asking, is it better to receive a targeted therapy versus not for the respective genotypes, with an overall survival as the primary endpoint? And so it's really putting to test the idea that these are targeting these pathways is effective in the advanced disease setting. Will it increase the cure rate of early stage lung cancer with the appropriate mutations?
And of course, no lung cancer interview nowadays can be complete without asking what you do in your own practice outside a trial setting, both with EGFR and ALK rearranged patients. Do you offer, will you give these agents outside a trial setting?
In the adjuvant setting?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a discussion that I have with the patients. Certainly someone who's got lymph node positive disease, you know, N2 positive disease, where you have an exceedingly high risk of recurrence, there are the ones that I tend to lean towards using these agents outside of clinical trials. It's more of a discussion in the earlier stage patients of whether to do that or not. But unfortunately, we all know that the reality of the situation is that, you know, even for stage 2 lung cancer patients, the recurrence risk and chance of dying from lung cancer is quite high. And so we want to try to do everything possible to prevent that.
Kind of reminds me of some of the arguments that are raging right now in breast cancer. And a lot of your colleagues there, Dana-Farber, very much involved with this, about pertuzumab, you know, such an encouraging agent. Now they're using neoadjuvant, but should you or can you use it in the adjuvant setting? What about in locally advanced disease? There's also a big intergroup study looking at using ALK inhibitors or EGFR inhibitors pre-chemo radiation therapy.
Yeah, so I think that's the other strategy, right? So in somebody who you could sort of really debulk the disease with a targeted therapy, get the big response, have then a lower mass of residual disease that you then come in with chemotherapy and radiation. Yeah, absolutely. That could ultimately be beneficial. What that trial doesn't ask, of course, is that are there potentially other opportunities for individuals who are sort of not quite surgically resectable, but you find an ALK rearrangement, EGFR mutation, you give them the appropriate therapy, now they become surgically resectable. That's the other potential approach, not really being investigated, but something that could be looked at as well.
You know, also the issue, what to do on the back end after everything's done? Do you give people a couple of years of therapy? Another unknowable. Any thoughts? You know, when we talk about these questions, sometimes investigators will bring up the potential for harm. You know, it's one thing to say, well, we'll add something. Pertuzumab, for example, seems pretty unlikely that's going to cause harm. But some people cite a couple older trials, mainly related to EGFR, TKIs. Realistically, do you think there's a potential for harm by using either adjuvant or neoadjuvant TKI or ALK?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think the post-chemo RT, the SWOG trial, where there was a worse outcome with gefitinib versus placebo, and of course that was an era of using those drugs in patients that didn't, you know, weren't necessarily genotyped or genotyped at all. I think in the right patient population, we understand so much more about the biology of the cancer. I don't think that there's harm. The question really is there benefit? And I think even in the adjuvant setting, you know, we participated in the single arm adjuvant erlotinib trial for early stage EGFR mutant lung cancer, and duration of therapy there was 2 years. And we did have a substantial number of individuals who progressed after they stopped their therapy. And so did we just delay that ultimate progression to later? Maybe, but it did teach us something about that maybe these are also agents that need to be given perhaps for a longer period of time, et cetera. So I think that there are still a lot of learnings there that we don't quite understand.
So I think you were talking about the SELECT trial, and I'm curious what your experience was trying to get people through 2 years of erlotinib, and whether you think maybe these third generation agents with less or no, you know, EGFR wild type inhibition are going to be easier in the adjuvant setting.
Well, I think we certainly had a number of patients who dose reduced, and that's also true obviously in the advanced setting, but certainly in the adjuvant setting that's also true. I think that is the hope for these third generation drugs, that you could give them, hopefully not need to dose reduce them, and maybe give them for a longer period of time. You know, I think with the current agents, it's going to be difficult to get to the tamoxifen 5 or 10 year type of question. It may be different with agents that you can tolerate without major side effects for long periods of time.
So nowadays in lung cancer, you can talk for a long, long time without talking about chemo. We go an hour sometimes. But I did want to ask you about, we were talking about locally advanced disease, and at ASCO we saw finally, the results of the so-called PROCLAIM study looking at pemetrexed cisplatinum versus etoposide in cisplatinum. Can you comment on that paper and what you thought about it?
Yeah, it was actually nice to see it. We had heard about it for a while, and it was nice to see it. And I think we've, of course, been giving cisplatin and etoposide forever with radiation. And I do think that the data certainly supported that you could give cisplatin pemetrexed too with radiation. It certainly wasn't superior to EP, but it was certainly equivalent. And there are some differences, of course, in toxicity. Since we use pemetrexed for adenocarcinomas anyway, it makes sense to give platinum pemetrexed with radiation. You don't have alopecia, if that's an important consideration for individuals. You don't have to get chemotherapy 6 days in a row. You can get it once every 3 weeks. So there are some advantages there. And I think I certainly will probably start to use it more now that the data's out and can see it. It's too bad it wasn't better, but certainly I think is an option for somebody with adenocarcinoma who you're going to give chemo RT to.
Interesting. Let's talk about a couple other mutations. And one we get a lot of questions about are HER2 aberrations. I see you had this paper with Mark Chris et al., Annals of Oncology, that was looking at dacomitinib. But what do we know right now in general about these tumors?
Yeah, so this has been a little bit of a tough one. You know, HER2 mutations are sort of equivalent, I would say, to the EGFR exon 20 mutations. So HER2 mutations are essentially all in exon 20, like the EGFR exon 20 mutations. Preclinically, drugs like dacomitinib, neratinib seem to work pretty well, but they have been less successful in the clinic. So there's just a few cases of responses to the single agent dacomitinib. Single agent neratinib has been looked at. There was a presentation at ESMO last year. Neratinib temsirolimus has been looked at with some increase in activity. But by no means is this erlotinib for an exon 19 deletion EGFR mutant. And so there, I do think we still have some work to do. These are oncogenic alterations. They cause exactly the same sort of properties in preclinical models as EGFR mutants. I just don't think we perhaps have the right drug or the right drug combination yet to treat these cancers. But we find them because people are doing sequencing. We find patients with these alterations all the time.
Do you also see HER2 amplification as in breast cancer?
Less so. Some, but less so. I think it's mostly the mutations.
Interesting. What about RET mutations? It sounds like that one's up and coming pretty quickly.
That one's up and coming too. Again, another rearrangement. There you have lots of drugs that potentially are RET inhibitors. Of course, they're not specific RET inhibitors. Things like cabozantinib, sunitinib, vendetinib, sorafenib. These are all RET inhibitors, but they all have multitude of other kinase targets. At ASCO this year, there was data on cabozantinib. Certainly was some activity really showing that this is a targetable patient population with this class of drugs. I think also showed to us that there is toxicity of this class of drugs in terms of dose reductions. Of course, and with this class of drugs, hand-foot syndrome is really the main issue. There is some hope for alectinib, actually, which is an ALK inhibitor, but also is a RET inhibitor, and there will be an ongoing or a future clinical trial looking at alectinib in RET patients. So maybe with the right drug or a drug that doesn't have these other side effects, there's a possibility of having a very good, effective, and tolerable therapy. But clearly, I think the RET patients are the same, meaning this is an oncogene that caused the growth of the cancer. Finding the right way to treat these patients is important.
And again, I think what I'm hearing is that maybe the responses that are seen are maybe, let's say, more useful than what you were describing with HER2 mutations.
Yeah, I think better there than HER2 mutations, I think, but again, not quite at the ALK or ROS level still. And whether that's the drugs that we're using or whether that's biology, and still to be determined. But clearly some hints that it's working.
So I'm just kind of trying to read between the lines here. It sounds like you're not that excited, at least from a clinical point of view, about finding HER2 mutations, definitely a research point of view. Same thing with RET. I mean, if you see somebody with a RET mutation, are you ready to treat outside of trial?
Yeah, I think RET, we have more options to treat them also, and there are multiple drugs that could potentially be used. HER2 is tougher because outside of trials, really the only HER2 targeted option that people have used is trastuzumab. Trastuzumab with chemotherapy is often used, and it's okay. It's not great. It's okay. It has some activity, but it could certainly be better. And so that's an area that's sort of in desperate need for better and more effective targeted therapies. I think in the RET world, definitely there's activity of cabozantinib, and we have used it outside of a clinical trial as well. But I think there the hope is to hone in on and potentially find an even better therapy that perhaps wouldn't be quite as toxic.
What about BRAF? Can you talk about the types of mutations that are seen and which are responsive to BRAF inhibitors, and also the idea of combining BRAF with MEK, which we saw some data on at ASCO?
Yeah, so the BRAF mutations, so lung cancer, unlike melanoma, is about 50% BRAF V600E and 50% non-BRAF V600E. Melanoma, of course, is almost exclusively V600E. The BRAF inhibitors by themselves have okay activity, about 30% response rate. The BRAF MEK inhibitors have a significant activity, over 60% response rate. So what we've seen at ASCO this past year, dabrafenib, trametinib, you know, almost similar activity as you see in melanoma. So that's really an active combination. And I think for an individual that has that mutation, it seems to be working very well. The duration is not quite there yet. It's just early on, but certainly the response rate looks encouraging. The other BRAF mutations, the non-V600E or the exon 11 BRAF mutations, they're unlikely to benefit from BRAF inhibitors. They may benefit from MEK inhibitors, just not enough data to know that yet.
Interesting. So what do you do right now if you have a patient with a V600E mutation, they can't go into a trial? What are you doing now, and is it different than what you did before ASCO?
Well, I think that there's pretty good data to show the response. You know, if I found somebody who couldn't go on the trial, I tried to get the drugs for them outside the trial. I mean, I think the activity was pretty good, especially if the person's received prior chemotherapy.
But you give both?
Yeah, both. I mean, both, because both is, of course, an approved regimen for melanoma. So there's a lot of safety information with both. You don't get the skin squamous cell cancers that you get with BRAF inhibitors by themselves. So there's that improvement in the sort of the safety profile as well. So I think, yeah, both, especially after ASCO.
About how many patients have you given BRAF inhibitors to, and what have you seen in terms of toxicity? We hear stories from melanoma, but I'm not sure it's going to be the same thing with lung cancer. Maybe the patients aren't going to be treated as long, but what have you seen?
Handful. Sometimes you do see the skin outgrowths as well, as you do in melanoma.
What about, I mean, I know you're in Boston where there's no sun, but you hear terrible stories about sunburn.
Yeah, I don't have as much experience on that front. You're right. We haven't seen the sun too much up here.
Buried under snow for the last year, it seems, pretty much. We were talking about next generation sequencing, and one of the common questions that oncologists have in dilemmas is the patient with non-small cell who's going through the usual approved therapy, wild-type disease, and, you know, still wants to be treated. For practical purposes, you know, what happens when you order, you know, a test like Foundation One? How often does it really end up benefiting the patient, and in what ways?
Yeah, I guess it depends on what the person has had done previously, meaning that, you know, if you've tested for EGFR, ALK, and ROS previously, you know, there's certainly some chance of finding an alteration, especially if the person's a never smoker or a limited smoker, that chance is higher. But even in individuals who are smokers, you find sometimes the BRAF mutations. The other exciting new area of mutation are these MET exon 14 skip mutations, which seem to be sensitive to MET inhibitors, and you do actually find those in smokers as well as never smokers. So it isn't a completely phenotypically restricted effort. So there is some chance of finding it. I guess if you've never sequenced somebody, if the patient has never been genotyped, then absolutely, I think it's worth it just to make sure you don't have an alteration that you've missed. I think the chance is lower when you've been tested for EGFR, ALK, and ROS, but not zero.
So I'm always looking for, you know, sort of virtual consensuses, which means if I ask 25 investigators, they all say the same thing. And I've been hearing a lot of people saying the same answer to this question, which is, let's say you have a patient up front, they've just presented with metastatic adenocarcinoma, and, you know, you've tested them for EGFR, ALK, BRAF, ROS1 maybe, and they're a non-smoker. Do you send them at that point up front for next-gen sequencing?
I typically would. I think the a priori probability of finding something is still pretty high. They could have HER2, they could have RET, they could have, you know, they could still have something. I think that negative information tells you that you start them on chemotherapy, though. I don't think you wait for that data, but I think you get the data.
Yeah, so, and that's the answer I've heard from everybody. It makes complete sense. I guess one of the things I also wonder about, and, you know, now you're talking about, you know, pretty infrequent events that you're looking for, but one thing I've heard, again, that kind of concerns me are people who are found to have ALK rearrangements on next-gen sequencing who are negative on ALK and conventional testing. How often does that occur? I've heard their responses, you know, to crizotinib in these patients. Is that the case?
Yeah, so I think the ALK FISH testing is one that is not a kind of a black and white test. And there's some, you know, you're looking for signals that are fairly close to each other to split a little bit further. And then you have to have a certain number of those events above and beyond sort of baseline. And so there is some operator variability, specimen variability. And so sometimes I think you can be falsely positive while falsely negative. And whereas sequencing, you know, if you see the fusion in the sequencing, it's probably real. And it is probably not a false positive. So, you know, I think the other thing that people are commonly using or more commonly using now for ALK is immunohistochemistry, because, of course, ALK is not normally expressed essentially in adults. And so if you find expression in a lung tumor, it's essentially aberrant until proven otherwise. And so that's the other way to kind of figure out these discrepancies.
Again, thinking about the newly diagnosed patient, smoker or non-smoker, you know, for years, we've been hearing from people and investigators, particularly at tertiary centers, oh, yeah, every single patient, I mean, some places, every patient with every tumor is getting some kind of multiplex testing. But in terms of adenocarcinoma of the lung, it hasn't been sort of exactly recommended, I would say, to docs in practice. But when you start thinking about the issue of tissue conservation, you wonder whether or not that kind of should be standard. Has there been discussion about actually kind of moving multiplex testing as part of standard of care, or do you still see it as part of a research platform?
Yeah, I think certainly we're moving in that direction. Essentially, all of our adenocarcinoma patients who are newly diagnosed will get targeted next-generation sequencing. And I think we can, in fact, get more information of a smaller biopsy that way than we could previously, where you had to send it to lab one to do the genotyping, and then you had to cut some more sections to do FISH for ALK or ROS, et cetera. And in a way, from one biopsy, you can get multiple pieces of information by next-generation sequencing. So I do think that there is value to that. I think the issue that continues to evolve is, how do you pay for that? You know, what do you need to show for that? Do you need to show that it's better to get that done versus not get it done? And that makes ultimately a difference. And I think certainly in the right patient population, knowing the genotype, of course, makes a difference because you find the EGFRs and ALKs, et cetera. So we're definitely moving into that. And I think also, you know, we're not the only institution that's doing that. Others are doing that as well. And I think you get a lot of information. I think the challenge with next-gen sequencing is that it's not quite as fast as you'd like it to be. You're still waiting weeks. And so, for example, in our patients who come to see us, newly diagnosed adenocarcinoma, we will have a sort of a more rapid way to assess ALK by immunohistochemistry or allele typing for EGFR, just to make sure that if we found one of those, that would trigger a TKI instead of chemotherapy for advanced disease. And there we don't have the 3 or 4 weeks to wait. We got to know the answer quickly. So it has some limitations as well.
And you also hear about people who are sick and need a decision soon. You hear about older people who you think will never be candidates for chemotherapy. Are there any situations where you might use targeted therapy without knowing the target's there?
Yeah, I think we do less and less of that. You know, never smoker, about a 40% chance of having an EGFR mutation, but I think still that empiric use of EGFR inhibitors is still pretty low. Plasma, of course, offers that potential, right? So, you know, if I can tell you in 24 hours you don't or do not have an EGFR mutation, that's important quickly to be able to tell that difference. Don't have the biopsy, but can always get the blood.
So another thing I want to ask you about in terms of EGFR, initially we saw some data related to afatinib. Now in the JCO, there were, I think, data including erlotinib and gefitinib. In terms of response based on EGFR mutation, particularly EGFR19 versus L858R, can you talk about what we've learned there? And is this specific to afatinib or just a class effect?
Yeah, so certainly in the pooled afatinib analysis, it seemed like the patients who had the exon 19 deletion had a survival advantage over chemotherapy when treated with afatinib compared to the L858R mutation. And up until this point, I mean, we've certainly learned that in multiple studies, not all of them, that if you look at efficacy in the two different main mutant categories, some studies show a benefit, some studies don't show a benefit in terms of the differences. And it's always in favor. The ones that are positive are always in favor of the exon 19 deletion intent. And clinically, we sort of think about that as the money mutation. That is usually the one that's associated with a higher degree of response and a better response. Whether there will be an actual difference with the other TKIs, hard to know. Whether there's a differential between afatinib and erlotinib and exon 19 deletions will be hard to know. So there, as you know, there is an ongoing and completed phase 3 clinical trial of afatinib versus gefitinib in EGFR mutants in the frontline setting, the so-called LuxLung-7 trial. A trial of dacimitinib versus gefitinib also completed accrual. And there, of course, we can directly compare not only the two agents in the common EGFR mutant categories, but in the specific genotypes as well. And I think that'll give us a definitive piece of information.
Roughly what fraction are exon 19 as opposed to L858R or others?
The 19 and L858R are about equivalent. Both are about 40-45% of EGFR mutations. Together, they make up about 85% of all EGFR mutations.
So I actually had a doc from Australia email me saying he heard on one of our programs, amazing how people pick these things up, about the exon 20 insertion that you mentioned before. His question was, do you ever use an EGFR TKI? It seems like most people start with chemotherapy, but are TKIs useless or maybe something to consider down the line? Do you see useful responses?
Not completely useless, but certainly the lack of activity is significant. There have been some reports of even erlotinib having activity in some subsets of the exon 20 insertions, some activity of dacimitinib and afatinib. I think they're mostly isolated responses as opposed to, you know, if you look across the board there really isn't a lot of activity. So I think that too is an area where we're, just like the HER2 insertion mutations, an area where there's a need for better therapies or new types of EGFR inhibitors.
How do you approach outside a trial setting the selection of a TKI, specifically afatinib versus erlotinib?
I personally use erlotinib. I think for me, there is a higher degree of toxicity of afatinib in my mind compared to erlotinib when used as initial therapy. The question of the exon 19 deletion issue, again, the comparison there is to chemotherapy. It's not to, is afatinib versus erlotinib better in exon 19 deletion patients? And again, that information will come out in the LuxLung-7 trial. So I tend to use erlotinib.
In the patient who started on either one of those drugs, let's say erlotinib, because that's obviously more commonly used, Is there any role at all for following that up with single agent afatinib on relapse? Do you see clinically useful responses? Is it something to even consider?
Well, I think the LUX-Lung-1 trial will tell us that the likelihood of afatinib working in that situation is quite low. You know, less than 10% response rate, a short PFS. Same is true for dacomitinib. And neither one of those agents are very good at inhibiting EGFR T790M, which, of course, is the common reason patients develop resistance. So we tend not to do that at all.
What about cetuximab, afatinib? Initially, I was all excited when I saw the waterfall plot, and then, of course, then the third-generation agents came along. But what's going on with that regimen? Is it being studied? Do you think there's a role for it, particularly in a T790 mutation negative?
Yeah, so I think, you know, in that initial study, there was about a 25% response rate in both T790 negatives and positives, PFS of about 4.7 months or so. So certainly for the negatives, it is something that potentially could be used. I think the challenge with that regimen, of course, is toxicity. And, you know, you have two drugs that are very good inhibitors of wild-type EGFR, and toxicity is not insignificant. There is still, I believe, an ongoing phase 3 clinical trial or a randomized phase 2 clinical trial of cetuximab afatinib versus afatinib as initial treatment in EGFR mutant lung cancer. Whether that trial will able to be completed given the emergence of the third generation drugs and moving into that space remains to be determined, but I think so far ongoing.
You have so many trials available, I don't know if it ever gets to this, but have you, for example, in the last year used that combination outside a trial setting?
No.
Have you used it at all?
Outside a trial setting? No, have not.
When you have used it within a trial setting, you mentioned the wild type effects. I've heard a lot about the skin effects. I didn't think about GI. Do you see GI problems too?
See some, but I think it's the skin really predominates. You certainly see diarrhea. You can see grade 3 diarrhea, but the skin really predominates in that one.